your audience, you know, like you, you know, going too deep or not deep enough and so forth. And so when I got feedback last night that there were some individuals who said, oh yeah, this is old hat, we know about all this. And others said, wow, this is just like, I can't get up to this. I said, well, that must mean it's just about right, okay? it's enough in the middle of the road that I'm getting hit by trucks going both ways. So I hope that that you weren't lost completely last night. The crux of Dr. Van Til's distinctive approach to defending the faith is that he centers on presuppositions. But that forces us to ask, what do we mean by the term presupposition? How are we using that concept? And then that leads to the question, how do you prove your presuppositions? In what manner do you go about showing that your fundamental assumptions are correct over against competing or alternative systems of thought? And the word that, if I communicated to you last night and it made sense at all, the word that should be predominant in your thinking now is the word transcendental. That's not common parlance. It's not even real common among philosophers, although historically it has been. So don't feel bad if you don't, you know, recognize that terminology right away. That's fine. But let me show you how the word transcendental answers both the question, what does Van Til mean by a presupposition, as well as how do you prove your most fundamental assumptions or your presuppositions? As Mike indicated in the introductory remarks, there are really three different approaches to this term presupposition. Some people think a presupposition is a hypothesis, your working assumption, and your hypothesis is subject to verification by independent considerations. So I will, for the time being, assume the following to be true. That's my presupposition. But I'll always be on the lookout for logical or experiential or historical or scientific considerations that will confirm or disconfirm my hypothesis. Van Til doesn't use the word presupposition that way. Another notion of presupposition now is not something that's a hypothesis subject to prove, but something that it's unprovable. It's an axiom. You voluntarily choose, this is my beginning point, and then you deduce your conclusions from there. And so that's another use of the word presupposition, but Van Til doesn't agree with that either. To put it very simply, for Van Til, our presuppositions are our most basic philosophy of life, our view of reality, our view of how we know what we know, our view of how we should live our lives. And that fundamental philosophy gives us a what he calls point of reference. It's what we're always going back to get our orientation or our perspective. It gives us our guidance. It gives us a standard for considering everything. But now, is that presupposition provable? One of the persistent criticisms that has been made about Dr. Van Til, and it almost always is evidence that the critic has not read Van Til for himself, but is just taking the word presupposition and drawing his own conclusions. One of the persistent criticisms of Van Til is that he's a fideist. Just a person who says, we begin with a faith commitment, there's no proof for it, you just start there and then you go out and you live your life and you try to regiment your life and be consistent with that faith commitment. But Van Til did not believe that our fundamental presupposition, our philosophy of life that gives us our point of reference, is unprovable. He said it is in fact a transcendental, the philosophical word for that belief or set of beliefs that makes something else intelligible. Van Til said if you do not have the Christian point of reference that's given to us by God's revelation, you cannot make intelligible, you cannot make sense out of other forms of proof. And so last night we looked at the history of philosophy. That's the part you all enjoyed so much, right? Descartes, who was the rationalist, and said, we have self-evident truths that we begin with. Or you have Locke and Berkeley and Hume, the empiricists, who said, no, we go to our sensations, our observations of the world, and we prove things from that. And then in the end, when those two schools of philosophy reduce the skepticism, Immanuel Kant comes along. He doesn't really have an answer, but his approach to the problem is we need to ask what has to be true in order to make sense out of observation. What has to be true in order to make sense out of logic and self-alleged, self-evident truths? That's what's known as a transcendental method of reasoning. asking what are the preconditions for the intelligibility of something else. And Van Til's claim, and this is the essence of last night's lecture now, Van Til's claim is our presuppositions as Christians, taken from the Bible, are the transcendental that is needed by anybody to make sense out of their logical reasoning, their historical reasoning, their scientific reasoning, whatever it may be. Christianity is true because of the impossibility of the contrary. Christianity is true because without it, you couldn't prove anything at all. That's the presuppositional genius of Dr. Van Til's system. Well, so we see that Van Til is not at all a fideist. He doesn't just make this blind faith commitment and try to live in terms of it as an act of will. He believes that Christianity is fully and rationally provable in a transcendental fashion. Without the Christian's presuppositions, we can't make sense out of any argument at all. He's not a fideist. But you know what's going to happen? This leads into my second lecture. People are now going to go the other way and say, oh, Van Til, his problem isn't that he doesn't prove enough. His problem is that he proves way too much. Because, you see, if what he is saying is true, then unbelievers don't know anything, do they? Unbelievers, not having Christian presuppositions, can't make sense out of logic, can't make sense out of observation, can't make sense out of history and science and so forth. And therefore, unbelievers don't have any foundational, you know, provable assumption on which they have learned everything they've learned, so they don't know anything at all. The charge then is that presuppositionalism implies that unbelievers can't know anything. And this has been another one of those persistent criticisms made of Van Til by, I think, unread critics throughout the 20th century. It's always fascinating to see the way in which criticism of a position, which if you think is true, anyway, is true, tends to cancel, the criticisms cancel each other out. Van Til has been accused of being a fideist by people, but on the other hand, he's been accused of saying that unbelievers can't know anything. Well, now, which is it now? I mean, is it that everyone knows things and we just make a faith commitment? Or is it we're the only ones who know things? Well, Van Til didn't hold either one of those positions, and that's why I've come this morning to lecture to you. If you are to understand Van Til, you must understand the notion of self-deception. Because according to Van Til, the absolute contrast between the Christian and the non-Christian in the field of knowledge is one of principle. That is to say, he draws the distinction between what he called the regenerated consciousness, which in principle sees the truth, and the unregenerate consciousness, which by its principle cannot see the truth. But it's in principle that Christians see the truth. Van Til didn't think Christians were always right in what they said. But in principle they could be right because they had a solid foundation. On the other hand, non-Christians, in principle, can't see the truth at all. But that is in principle. Given their approach to things, their unregenerated consciousness, their way of thinking, in principle, they couldn't see any truth. If unbelievers were totally true to the assumptions that they espouse, and when you argue with somebody, they say, well, I believe this, I believe. If they were true to all those things they claim to believe, then indeed knowledge would be impossible for them. They would be denying God. They'd have no foundation for their logic, no foundation for their scientific work, and on and on. However, the Christian can challenge the non-Christian approach to interpreting human experience, and I'm quoting, only if he shows the non-Christian that even in his virtual negation of God, he is still really presupposing God. And so Van Til put his whole system together most succinctly in a three-word summary. I don't think have you ever seen the show Name That Tune? You know, where people are supposed, they're given some kind of clue as to what the tune's going to be, and they say, I can name that tune in, what, seven notes? And then the other person, I can name that in four notes, and back and forth. Well, if you had to summarize Van Til in three words, what would it be? I challenge anybody to get lower than this. I don't think it can be done. Van Til once said, this is from him, anti-theism presupposes theism. Boy, that is powerful stuff. Reflect on that. Go home and think about that. What Van Til maintains is unbelievers say one thing about their philosophy, and they try to live in terms of it, but all along they are presupposing Christianity to be true anyway. Antitheism, in order to be intelligible, in order to argue your antitheistic point of view, you already have to presuppose theism. You have to work within the framework of Christian theism in order to argue against Christian theism. Now do you see why this is such a powerful apologetic? No one can escape it. But there have been people who said, Van Til, what you're saying is unbelievers can't know anything at all. And the genius of Van Til is, first of all, he says, in principle, they could know nothing at all. And in fact, they never can get away from presupposing God. So they are able to know things. What does Paul tell us in Romans, the first chapter? Paul says that what can be known about God is plain within them, that is, the unbelieving world, because God made it plain to them, these things being clearly perceived from the created order, being intellectually apprehended from the things that have been made, so that they, the unbelievers, are without excuse. And so Paul says that unbelievers have no excuse for what they are professing, what they're saying, because they know in their heart of hearts the God that they're denying. In fact, in verse 21 of Romans 1, Paul categorically depicts unbelievers as, quote, knowing God. In verse 18, he says that they, in their unrighteousness, hold down or suppress the truth. And so the biblical picture of the unbeliever is not the picture that you get if you just watch the debate between believers and unbelievers. Because if you just watch the debate, it appears that one side believes in God and these theological things, and the other side denies those things. And so now it's just a matter of how can we go out and find evidence to determine which of these hypotheses is true. Van Til, following the Apostle Paul, says, but it really isn't that way at all. Because one side believes what the other side believes, but won't admit it. And in fact, not only will they not admit that they believe in God, they have to be depending upon God in order to argue against God. That's why one of the most precious illustrations Van Til used, and he had many homey, wonderful illustrations, was that of a young girl that he saw on the train one day in Philadelphia, sitting on her father's lap, and in her insolence and rebellion against her father, reached up and slapped her father in the face. Van Til said, what a picture of the unbeliever. If he were not sitting on his Heavenly Father's lap, he couldn't insult his Heavenly Father. And so God is supporting even those who are rebelling against him. And intellectually, you can't make sense of the rebellion, the arguments, the criticisms. You can't make intellectual sense out of them apart from God actually being who he said he is and existing. And so when people say presuppositionalism by arguing that Christianity is the transcendental, the precondition for the intelligibility of all human reasoning, people say when presuppositionalists claim that, they're making unbelievers know nothing, and so that's absurd. Van Til's answer is, well, Romans 1 tells us they do know things because even though they claim not to know God, they really do know God. And so we might go home at this point, or at least take an early coffee break this morning, and say, well, that settles everything, right? Well, except for one problem, that does seem to be an outright contradiction. Now, some people are not worried about contradictions, but us presuppositionalists are. And so that troubled Van Til. It troubles all Van Tilians. It troubled this one enough that he did his doctoral dissertation on that subject. How can we say unbelievers who don't know God according to the Bible, they aren't saved after all, nevertheless know God? How can you make sense out of all of that? This is a very problematic approach to the unbeliever. I mean, it solves two problems. It solves the problem of how you can prove God's existence to the unbeliever, and yet how he, you know, is in no position to argue against you. So that's great. But the presupposition of the one contradicts the presupposition of the other. You know what I'm getting at? We're saying that at one and the same time, unbelievers are believers. Okay, so the theme of today's lecture is, and then I'm going to try to make sense out of it for you, that unbelievers, according to Van Til, were secret believers. Unbelievers were secret believers. They never want to admit the fact that they're secret believers, and in genuine sincerity, unbelievers will tell you that they don't believe. And nevertheless, they are secret believers. In philosophy, this is what we call self-deception. Self-deception. A person who knows the truth but lies to himself about it so that he brings himself to believe contrary to what he knows to be the case. That's a very perplexing notion, philosophically. Because, Jean-Paul Sartre put it well when he said, how can I perform this project of deceiving myself if it calls for me to know very well, in order to conceal my belief, the belief that I'm concealing? How can I, at one and the same time, believe something and not believe something? Because, you see, as the one who is deceived, I believe some proposition that's false. But as the person who is deceiving, I know that proposition is false, so I don't believe it. So when you have two people working at this project of deception, it all fits in well. One person doesn't believe it and deceives the other person into believing it. But now if you bring the deceiver and the deceived into one person, Sartre says, now how is that possible? He's not the only one. Many philosophers, in fact, since 1960 with a really groundbreaking article by Raphael Demas on lying to oneself, the journals have been filled with the discussion. Now, what do we make of this idea that I can believe something as deceived and yet not believe it as the deceiver? How can this be possible? Van Til says that unbelievers are secret believers. They have deceived themselves. And throughout his scholarly career, which I suppose everyone here knows I have the highest regard for, this seemed to be the real Achilles heel for Van Til. He never gave up saying that, but he struggled with how to resolve that problem. In fact, I quote him here. He admits the problem of the unbeliever's knowledge, and now the quote, has always been a difficult point, often the one great source of confusion on the question of faith in its relation to reason. The reason why he said that faith in the relation to reason stumbles over this is that if you're an Augustinian, which is Van Til's theological and philosophical background, if you're an Augustinian, you disagree with the tradition of natural theology and evidentialism that says that faith is placed upon the fundament of reason, that reason builds up a foundation and then faith can be placed on that foundation of reason. That's what Thomas Aquinas said. You have a foundation of reason, faith placed on it. Augustine, on the other hand, said, I must believe in order to understand. In order to use reason, in order for my intellect to be fruitful, I have to begin with faith. And so faith is the foundation for reasoning. Well, and by the way, plenty of unbelievers just do not comprehend that challenge. They just don't get it. George Smith, who is a well-known atheist, who wrote the book on, atheism? No, I'll get it right. A Handbook of Atheism or something, in which he went through all these arguments and so forth and so on. I was on a radio program with him once discussing this question of how we can know whether God exists and so forth. And when I put to him that from our Christian perspective, faith is not what we add to reasoning. He had said, you see, the problem with you Christians is you reason so far, and then faith takes over. So faith is always unreasonable. And I said, no, George, you haven't understood. We don't say that faith goes beyond reason. We say reason doesn't start until you have the foundation of faith. I mean, it was just bewildering to him to hear, what are you talking about? I said, what I'm saying is that in order to reason, in order to make sense out of reasoning, you have to have the foundation of Christian faith. Well, that's irritating to unbelievers because they say, I don't believe those things. I don't have Christian faith, and yet I'm reasoning. Van Til's argument was, you do rest on faith. But he says, this is the great problem, though, because now we're forced to tell unbelievers, we're forced to tell unbelievers that they are believers. Not people who are saved by, you know, the blood of Christ because they're trusting, but they believe what the Bible says to be true. They believe in God and so forth, and yet they are called unbelievers. And so Van Til acknowledged this has always been a difficult point. Van Til knew very well what charge would be made against his apologetic. I quote him again. It is ambiguous or meaningless, says the critic, to talk about the natural man as knowing God and yet not truly knowing God. Knowing is knowing. A man either knows or he does not know. He may know less or more, but if he does not truly know, he knows not at all. In reply to this, the presuppositionalist insists that the natural man does not know God. But to be thus without knowledge, without living, loving, true knowledge of God, he must be one who knows God in the sense of having the sense of deity, Romans 1. In order to be an unbeliever, somebody who doesn't love God, somebody who doesn't want to reason in subordination to God, he must already have the sense of deity. He must already know God in his heart of hearts, as Romans 1 says. And so Van Til was real sensitive to this charge of contradiction, unlike some critics of Van Til who say, we don't care about logic. Van Til always cared about logic. And he said, so when it looks like we're saying something illogical, we need to deal with that. And so he would say, and I quote him, non-Christians know after a fashion, as Paul tells us in Romans, end of quote. Van Til said there must be two senses of the word knowledge that are used in Scripture to make sense of this. Sometimes he said, believers know truly, unbelievers know falsely. That's a real paradoxical way of putting it, of course. Van Til said that unbelievers have an axe to grind, that they hide the facts from themselves, so forth. Sometimes he talked about believers knowing things and unbelievers knowing them deep down in their minds, knowing it without recognizing. Now, in all of this struggle to make sense out of Romans 1, which is really pivotal for a presuppositional defense of the faith, I want to make clear that Van Til did not hold, as some of his, I think, naive disciples have put it, that unbelievers are simply liars. He did not run to the easy alternative that, well, they know God, and it's very well right before their consciousness. They're very aware of it. They know God, and then they tell everybody, oh, I don't know God. Like, say, a child who's broken a vase when his mother was at the store. And then she comes home and finds the mess, and she says, Johnny, did you break that vase? And he knows. I mean, it's just right there. He can even visualize what he did to, you know, to do this. And he goes, no, Mom, I didn't do it. I mean, that's just an outright, what we call, a bald lie. Van Til did not hold that unbelievers were just baldly lying, that they're saying, oh, yeah, well, I know very well I believe in God, but I'll never admit it. And we'll get me to cry, Uncle. Van Til did not have that naive, unrealistic, and artificial a view of the situation. And so we have before us the difficulty this morning of making sense out of self-deception. Okay. The temptation might be at the beginning of our project to just give up and say, we don't have to talk this way. We always have the alternative to give up, you know, certain ways of certain kinds of linguistic behavior. Why don't we just give up the notion of self-deception? Some philosophers have done that. I said there's a lot in the literature since the 1960s on this question. Some philosophers have just said, well, I mean, that's an interesting metaphor, but obviously it couldn't literally be true, so just don't talk that way. Or if you talk that way, recognize you're being poetic, you're being metaphorical, and let it go with that. Well, the problem that I have with that is that even though the notion of self-deception is enigmatic, it's all too familiar a notion to just give up and say we don't know what we're talking about. Popular and cynical platitudes about man's proclivity to self-deception have been published in Western literature continuously since the days of Demosthenes. Benjamin Franklin once quipped, "Who has deceived thee so often as thyself?" We have treatises on self-deception from Puritan preachers. Bishop Butler, one of his most famous sermons, was entitled Upon Self-Deceit. In it, he said, a man may be entirely possessed of this unfairness of mind without having the least speculative notion what the thing is. He's exactly right. References to self-deception are found in Plato, Rousseau, Goethe, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Jean-Paul Sartre. I mean, from beginning to end, this has been a well-known, familiar notion. And it's not just in the works of the philosophers that we find it. We find it in the works of sociologists and economists, Karl Marx, Karl Mannheim. We find it in great works of literature, from Sophocles' Oedipus Rex to Shakespeare's The Tragedy of King Lear. We see it in Dickens and Flaubert. We see it in Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. We see it in O'Neill, The Iceman Cometh, André Gide's Pastoral Symphony, Camus' The Fall. Now, we could just kick it out, you know? Philosophers say, we don't know what we're talking about. But that really seems artificial in light of the fact that we're all very familiar, and it's been spoken of in all Western cultures throughout literature, philosophy, sociology, psychology, on and on it goes. The vocabulary of self-deception is easily recognizable by us. Even children can master how to talk about self-deception. We teach others about self-deception. The notion that we aren't making any sense and no one knows what they're talking about, we certainly shouldn't be inclined to it as the easy way out. When I tell you that the son of Mrs. Jones has been caught red-handed stealing lunch money out of students' desks at school, but that Mrs. Jones continues to protest her son's innocence, despite the fact that this is the third or fourth incident that's taken place, despite her discomfort and her red face when the subject of dishonesty comes up in casual conversations, despite the fact that she doesn't trust her son around her purse any longer, and she continues to explain his innocence with strange explanations like the school officials have a vendetta against little Johnny, they're out to frame the boy. Nobody finds it awkward to say the poor woman's deceiving herself. She knows that her son is guilty. That's why she doesn't trust him around her purse. That's why she's embarrassed when the subject of honesty comes up in conversations. And yet, on the other hand, she does all these things that outwardly appear to be rational, arguing for her son's innocence, insisting upon it, taking a stand, giving evidence, explaining contrary evidence, although in a contrived way. See, we don't have any difficulty saying Mrs. Jones is deceiving herself. And so we aren't going to be able to get rid of this as just a paradox that doesn't make any sense. What then should we say about self-deception? How can we make sense of it? And how can we do it in a short order here? Well, I want to suggest that in order to understand self-deception, it's first of all important that we have a realistic notion of belief. If you don't understand how beliefs work for individuals, you never understand how they can believe contrary to their beliefs. What is essential in self-deception is that people hold false beliefs, something that's unwarranted, and yet they hold it in a way that appears to be rational. It's unwarranted, they should know better, and yet they don't seem to know better. What is it to believe something? I'm going to give you a simple definition. When someone believes a proposition, I'm going to maintain that he has an action-guiding state of mind, that there's something mental that is oriented toward a proposition, as philosophers would say. So it's a propositional attitude, but it has there's a mental state and orientation, and that guides his behavior. It doesn't always, because we don't act upon all of our beliefs all the time. I believe that Winston Churchill once was popular in England, but I'm not acting upon that belief this morning, at least until I use it as an illustration. is that there are plenty of things that we believe that we don't act on all the time. But the point is, when we do act, we act in terms of the guidance or the perspective that our beliefs give us. If a person relies upon a proposition, sometimes intermittently or continuously, in the inferences that he draws or the practical actions and plans in which he engages, then we say he believes it. Now, a few important things to say about these action-guiding states of mind that we call beliefs. First of all, why do we ascribe such things to people? What is the basis, or what are the bases, for ascribing a belief to an individual? What is the mark by which we discern a belief in another individual? Well, one easy one is that person says, I profess the following. Or they just simply assert, you know, chocolate is good. You say, well, they said it. Unless we have evidence to the contrary, we'd say that's one of their beliefs. But now sometimes people don't say anything at all, and yet we ascribe beliefs to them, right? Have you ever heard the expression, actions speak louder than words? Well, you know, that little piece of common wisdom is true. Sometimes we look at the way people act and we say, you know, they believe something, even though we've never heard them say that they believe it. Okay, so that shouldn't be too hard for you to understand. The way in which we ascribe beliefs to people is pretty varied. It's based on their own testimony, but also on their observed behavior. Secondly, let's remember that not all the beliefs that we hold are consciously and rationally formed. It's one of the biggest problems that I think philosophers have. It's been noted by other philosophers that the prevailing way of doing philosophy is always to envision human beings as acting rationally. And that's why psychologists and philosophers don't get along very well, because psychologists almost always have to deal with the irrational side of human behavior. Even though it involves mental activity in life, we know very well, don't we? In fact, philosophers ought to know very well, people don't always act rationally. That's why we teach courses in logic. If people automatically did things rationally, we wouldn't have to teach them about logic, so they could correct their behavior, that is, their mental behavior and their ways of thinking. But not all of our beliefs are formed rationally. Not all of our beliefs are formed consciously. Some mornings I'm working away at my desk with the window open next to me, and there are birds chirping outside the window. Now, I hear the birds chirping. And if you were to ask me, do you believe birds are chirping outside the window? Say you called up, and I answered the phone, and you say, Dr. Bonson, are the birds chirping outside? I'd say, yeah. But that doesn't mean that I was consciously thinking about the birds chirping while I was hearing them. Isn't that right? If I was doing my job right, I was thinking about what was on the computer screen, what I was typing out. And yet I do have this background noise, and I know what it is, and yet I don't consciously form a belief about it until I'm put on the spot and asked. So not all of our beliefs are consciously formed, and not all of our beliefs are rational, in the sense that they never contradict each other. Now, the next step in my description of belief behavior that people have is going to be the crucial one for you. And this is fascinating about human behavior, I think, that when we ascribe beliefs to ourselves, we're not always right. To put it in the language of the philosopher, self-ascription of belief is not incorrigible. You can correct the ascription of a belief to yourself. Sometimes we encounter overriding reasons to think that what we called our beliefs were false. Even our own reports of our beliefs are fallible. Now, I don't want to be unrealistic. Clearly, a person has a presumptive authority in terms of what he believes. When I say I believe the following, and someone else says I don't believe the following, you would presume that I know myself better than the other person. That's where you would begin, but that's only a presumption. It is possible for people to not understand themselves or to have motives for not seeing themselves clearly, right? Imagine you have somebody that you work with that professes, especially in light of political correctness and the desire to get ahead in the company, professes to have egalitarian opinions about people of other races. This person is very strong, very progressive, very up-to-date, has no discriminatory feelings about let's say black people, and that person is persistent in the profession of that at work, but you also know this person after work when he stops at the local bar and loosens up a bit with a few drinks with his friends. You know the kinds of jokes that he tells. You know who he doesn't want to hang out with, and on and on and on. Now, do we find it so difficult? I mean, is this just philosophical nonsense to say, you know, he thinks he believes in racial equality, but he doesn't? Actions speak louder than words. And so sometimes, we're not saying always, and we're not giving up the presumptive authority of a person over his own beliefs, but sometimes when a person professes to believe something, he's wrong about himself. He hasn't got it right. And the last thing about beliefs that I have to tell you before I can tie this together in terms of self-deception is that beliefs are to a certain degree voluntary. Now, the way in which that thesis has traditionally been refuted in philosophy is to imagine an artificial situation where if I were to go out this door here and the sun is shining, somebody says, now can you voluntarily believe that it's raining outside? And that is so hard, I don't know, maybe you'd have to have some psychological problem to be able to do it. It is very hard to do that, so people say, well then beliefs are not voluntary. But that's artificial also, because to a certain degree, in fact, to a large degree, beliefs are voluntary. We believe the sorts of things we want to. And you know how we do that? Not by going outside on a sunny day and saying, okay, now I'm going to force myself to think it's raining. It's by deciding what you're going to look at as evidence. Now, if I want to believe that it's raining outside, and I'm very well aware that if I go out that door, I'm going to see a sunny day, obviously, I'm not going to go out the door, am I? Okay, so the first step, now I'm not even sure I can do this, but at least it illustrates my point. The first step's going to be what? To make sure I turn away from the evidence. Okay? Now, there's other kinds of evidence, though. You see, I'm seeing shadows on this wall over here. Somebody might say, well, it must be sunny outside because shadows are being projected. Now I start dealing with the second line of evidence artificially. I say, yeah, but lights can do that, too. And there are lights in here. I'll bet the lights are making those shadows over there. Now, if I go far enough down this line, do you see what I'm getting at? I can choose not to deal with what would lead me to believe that it's sunny outside. And you know yourselves well enough, don't you? Do I have to give you any illustrations? Don't you do this? Don't we all do this? To a certain degree, we focus on the lines of evidence and we interpret those lines of evidence in a way that's favorable to what we think is going to be true or we want to be true. So now can we understand self-deception on the part of the believer? Unbeliever, pardon me. The unbeliever, according to Paul in Romans 1, knows God. He's got all the evidence. It's clear. He's without excuse. And the unbeliever gives plenty of behavioral evidence that he believes that God exists. He gives that evidence in his theoretical inferences. The fact that he holds, you know, very strongly to the invariance of the laws of logic. And on the other hand, says that the only thing that exists is material. And you say, no, wait a minute. How can the laws of logic be invariant if everything that's real is in flux, according to your philosophy? You see, he knows that they're invariant. He knows the laws of logic are unchanging because he knows God's mind, which is unchanging. But he doesn't want to call that God. So now he's got this kind of problem. So we see evidence. We see it in the fact that unbelievers are afraid to die. Not all of them, but that in some cases, they show that they know that there's something beyond that they're not prepared to deal with. We see it and they believe that there's uniformity in nature, even though they don't want to give credit to the sovereignty of God for it. It's fascinating that in Romans 1, Paul summarizes the wickedness of the unbelieving world when he says, neither gave they thanks. It all comes down to that. Unbelievers couldn't make sense of their mathematical formulas, their great musical symphonies. They couldn't make sense of their medical advances, their industrial success. They couldn't make sense of the crops that grow and their knowledge of history and the joy in their hearts. They couldn't make sense of any of that in light of their philosophy. They won't give thanks to God who makes it all possible. So we see evidence from the life of the unbeliever that he or she does indeed believe in God. And yet, on the other hand, there's this strong argument against God in many cases. I don't believe in God. There can't be a God. The evidence doesn't support there's a God. So we see contrived, rationalized approaches to evidence, to reasoning, to the facts, to one's own self-consciousness. Incompatible beliefs. But you have to understand, and I think we haven't gone so long that you're tuned out, you have to understand this crucial step. We're not saying that unbelievers must say P, the proposition God exists, and not P. That they are believing in one solitary, singular act of thinking, a contradiction. No, what I'm suggesting here is that the unbeliever knows that God exists, believes that God exists, but the unbeliever believes something else about himself, not about God, but about himself. And what he believes about himself, get this, is that he doesn't believe in God. You see, there's no contradiction in that. It may be a bad state of mind to be in, but there's no logical contradiction in that. Because the one belief is about God, and the other belief is about himself and what he believes. Okay? So, in philosophy, we call this iterated beliefs. You have a different level of believing. On the one level, we'll call this, you know, ground level. Believers, pardon me, let's just say non-Christians. Non-Christians believe in God. But then at the iterated level, as they look at their beliefs, as they're making a comment upon their lives, they make the mistake of saying, I don't believe in God. Now let's go back to, how do we know when people believe things and they don't believe things? Well, by profession, what they say verbally, that's not going to help us at this particular point. Not many unbelievers are going to come out and say, you know, I don't believe in God, but I really do. So that's not the way we're going to do that. But also by their actions, right? Now, what actions would lead a person to have a belief about his beliefs? What actions would lead us to have a belief about his beliefs? Well, how about what he says verbally? What if somebody says, I don't believe in God? We'd say, well, there's some evidence in there that he doesn't believe in God because he says he doesn't believe in God. He's pretty uncomfortable with that notion that there's a God. He sometimes gets pretty agitated about it. Okay? So that would be evidence that he doesn't believe in God. Yes? Oh, you jumped in too soon. Because it could also be evidence that he doesn't believe that he believes in God. The fascinating thing is that in some cases, an iterated belief has as its external visible manifestation the same manifestation as the belief at the ground level. All right. Do I believe that dogs are dangerous? Well, if I do believe that dogs are dangerous, I probably, when I'm walking down the street and there's some dog on the loose, I'm going to hesitate or go to the other side of the street or try to bribe the dog, you know, be a good doggy, want a biscuit. Things that I do may indicate that I think the dog's dangerous. But now what if I say, I don't think dogs are dangerous? Ah, who cares about dogs? I'm bigger than dogs. I can handle dogs. But then you see me walking down the street, and when I have a dog that's on the loose, I decide to go to the other side of the street or offer him a biscuit and start doing all this other kind of stuff that looks like I don't really have that confidence after all. Well, in that case, it's pretty obvious that I have given you evidence about what I really believe about dogs. I've said one thing, but I give you evidence to the contrary. Now, in the case of the unbeliever, self-deception, I think, takes that form. The unbeliever knows God, acts in terms of that knowledge of God, and yet when you look at the unbeliever's behavior, there's behavior that indicates he doesn't think he believes in God. He does believe in God, but about himself he has the belief that he doesn't. And since he thinks that he doesn't believe in God, he acts like an atheist. That's why he'll stand up and he'll debate people about God's existence. Or, you know, when people ask him, where do you go to church? I don't go to church. I don't believe in God. You know, he gives all this evidence. But it's not evidence that he doesn't believe in God. It's evidence that he doesn't believe about himself that he believes in God. So when we separate these two levels of belief and recognize that we can be mistaken about our beliefs, now it becomes possible to make sense out of self-deception, except for one other problem. How could you do this on purpose? How could you purposely separate your belief from the iteration of your belief and make that mistake? And the answer to that, because time is short, is that it's conceivable that a person could deceive himself about his deceiving himself. If you purposely go out of your way, and remember I said, I don't want to believe that it's sunny out there. So what do I start doing? I start taking actions where I don't have to look at the evidence, I don't have to interpret in a certain way, start turning away from it, I start distorting my ways of reasoning, being contrived and rationalizing, all that sort of thing. But now, if I purposely do that to myself, it isn't going to be very successful. I was purposely doing it in my illustration in this lecture. That's why I still believe it's sunny outside. Yes? You follow that? If I say, well, I'm going to have to bring myself to turn away from the evidence, as I'm turning away from the evidence, what am I thinking? Well, I'm turning away from the evidence. So if I'm going to deceive myself, it must be possible to deceive myself about my motives as well. At some point, when a man puts out his eyes, he can no longer watch himself doing it in the mirror. In the process of purposeful self-deception, it must be the case that you cover your self-deception with another self-deception about what you're doing. And now philosophers have argued, well, then how can there be a self-covering act of self-deception? And I would argue, well, we're all aware of at least one very common purposeful act of forgetting. And that's when we go to sleep. You know that if you think too hard about going to sleep, you can't go to sleep? Somebody might say, well, since you can't purposely go to sleep, no one will ever end up in bed. Yeah, you got to think about that. That's a philosopher's joke. If you purposely go to sleep, that means you're doing it deliberately, right? So imagine yourself lying in bed, like, gotta go to sleep, gotta go to sleep, gotta go to sleep. Well, as you know, you can't go to sleep that way. The harder you try to go to sleep, you don't go to sleep. So we say, well, then you can't purposely go to sleep. You can't deliberate and go to sleep, which indicates that no one can ever decide to go to bed because you can't purposely go to sleep. Well, that's ridiculous, isn't it? We all know what it is to have a self-covering intention when we go to sleep. You know, it ends up that you're tired of watching David Letterman and you say, I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to go to sleep now. You have purposely chosen to do it. And yet you know very well that in the process, at some point, you've got to stop reflecting on your purpose to do it, or else you'll never accomplish your purpose. There are self-covering intentions, therefore, and we're all familiar with them. So what is it for the unbeliever to deceive himself? I've given you some stories and illustrations and a few hooks philosophically about how to put this together. Let me give you the conclusion. Self-deception takes place when Sam believes a certain proposition. But Sam is motivated to ignore, hide, or deny his belief about that proposition. And thirdly, by misconstruing or rationalizing the evidence, Sam brings himself to believe falsely that Sam does not believe that proposition. Sam brings himself, by his rationalizing of the evidence, brings himself to believe about himself, I don't believe that proposition, and yet he's forcing himself, he's bringing himself to believe something that is false. In order to preserve something about his self-conception, his self-esteem, to use the word that is popular these days, in order to preserve his self-esteem, Sam engages in motivated rationalization of the evidence so that he relies in his theoretical and practical inferences on the proposition that he is not relying in his theoretical and practical inferences on that proposition. And the reason why he's culpable, morally culpable, for this lie about himself is because he engages in it intentionally. That doesn't mean that he's always aware of his intention, because it may have become habitual. He doesn't think about it anymore. It may become self-covering. It's become something he no longer thinks about, just like when we fall asleep. And so Sam obscures his dreaded belief that this proposition is true, as well as obscuring his intention to obscure that by rationalizing the evidence. And so self-deception involves deception of the self, by the self and for the sake of the self. That last part being crucial. For the sake of the self. For the sake of preserving your self-image, you'll lie to yourself, motivatedly lie to yourself, rationalize the evidence, and then fall asleep that that's what you're doing. I think this analysis of self-deception in terms of iterated beliefs, two levels of belief, the corrigibility of our disavowals. When we say, I don't believe something, we may be wrong about that. And motivated rationalization of evidence along with self-covering intentions will be adequate to explain the common illustrations as well as what's important to us as apologists, as well as what Paul says in Romans 1. Let's go back to Mrs. Jones as we conclude here. The principal calls Mrs. Jones to say that her little Johnny, her pride and joy, her only child, has been caught stealing lunch money out of students' desks. The evidence is plain that Johnny is a thief. This is the third time she's received such a call from the school. She's also noticed money missing out of her own purse at home. Johnny's been coming home with expensive items from the store. Mrs. Jones shows the effective symptoms of believing the proposition that Johnny is a thief. She tries to avoid situations where she is likely to be reminded of his dishonesty. She moves to a new neighborhood. She transfers Johnny to a new school. She won't put a phone in her new apartment, so she won't get those calls from the principal. She keeps an unusually attentive eye on her boy, but will never admit that she's doing that. Yet, on the other hand, since nobody in the Jones family has ever stooped to dishonesty, and her Johnny is her one reason left for living in this cruel world, she persuades herself that Johnny could not have done those dishonest deeds reported by the principal. She forgets the past evidence. She supplies to herself what she calls more credible explanations of the present evidence. Money's missing from her purse, but then, you know, she's such a forgetful and careless person, it's probably her own fault. She goes out of her way to express confidence in her son to others. She makes a show of giving him mature responsibilities. She embarrasses her friends with how proud she is about Johnny being a paragon of virtue. She avers that he's a fine boy who is a joy to her, a regular, upstanding citizen. Nevertheless, she flies off the handle at him over trifling matters in a way that was unlike her manner of treating him before the principal started calling. She astonishes and embarrasses others by seizing on every oblique innuendo to defend Johnny's honesty. And when neighbors get curious over her missing cash and Johnny's new acquisitions, Mrs. Jones fidgets, she blushes, she looks away, she changes the subject, she answers in a halting fashion. She treats the evidence that is broached in what we would say is a highly unusual, distorted way, all the while satisfying herself that her interpretations are quite plausible. Now, I maintain that in this situation, it's very natural to say Mrs. Jones is self-deceived. The effective symptoms justify attributing to her the belief that Johnny is a thief. She believes Johnny is a thief. Because she cannot stand the thought with its attendant psychic discomfort, she's motivated to hide this information from herself and now to direct her attention to evidence in what we would call odd ways. She dissents from believing that her son is dishonest. She claims the school officials had a vendetta against Johnny, were framing the poor boy. She leans on implausible interpretations of facts. She ignores the best, the most obvious indicators, and brings herself to believe that she does not believe in Johnny's dishonesty. She's not the mother of a crook. So she fools herself about her awareness of the truth. The symptoms of this false second-order belief are nearly identical with believing that it's not the case that Johnny is a thief. She conceives of herself as trusting this untrustworthy son, and while guarding herself against his untrustworthiness, she enthusiastically affirms her belief in him to others. She meets all the criteria of self-deception as I proposed it to you this morning. The analysis of self-deception that I've given you here is not only adequate to account for such mundane cases, but more importantly, I think it's adequate to explain what Paul tells us in Romans 1 of men who believe that God exists and yet suppress the truth unrighteously. This analysis strengthens and defends and advances the cause, therefore, of presuppositional apologetics. We can say all men know, and hence believe, that God exists. All men believe that God exists. The revelational evidence is so plain that nobody can avoid holding the conviction that God exists, even though they may never explicitly assent to that belief. We're justified in ascribing such a belief to men on the basis of their observed behavior in reasoning, their observed behavior in morals, their observed behavior emotionally, and so forth. Nevertheless, the Bible says all men are motivated in unrighteousness and by fear of judgment to ignore the evidence, hide the evidence, disavow any belief in the living and true God, either through atheism or false religiosity. By misconstruing and rationalizing the relevant, inescapable evidence around them, Paul says suppressing it, men bring themselves to believe about themselves that they do not believe in God, even though that second-order belief is a false one. Sinners can purposely engage in this kind of activity, for they also deceive themselves about their motivation in handling the evidence as they do. They deceive themselves about their real intentions, which are not noble, are not rational at all. To use my metaphor, thereby they go to sleep, forgetting their God. Because the evidence is clear, because the suppression of the truth is intentional, we can conclude properly that all men are without excuse, that they bear full moral responsibility for their sins of mind and speech and conduct, even though we've called it falling asleep to the truth. Given the elaboration of self-deception that I've offered, then, we can appreciate how Paul says in Romans 1 that knowing God, men suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And we are able to assert in a non-paradoxical way that unbelievers are culpable. They are guilty for deceiving themselves about their Maker. Van Til has said, in order to prove the Christian's presupposition, you must show the impossibility of the contrary. Without the Christian worldview, men couldn't know anything. Critics have said, oh, well, then you're claiming unbelievers are totally ignorant. They don't know anything. Van Til's response is, no, they do know things, but they won't acknowledge the foundation of their beliefs. They rationalize the evidence so they don't have to admit that they know this God. But it's only because they know this God that they can make sense out of their accomplishments in science and logic, whatever it may be. I know that I've gone a bit over time, but I want to leave you with something that's an important application. If you do follow this line about the self-deception of unbelievers, when you go to defend the faith with unbelievers, that is going to affect drastically your picture of what's going on in the argument, isn't it? I'll give you two scenarios to set this out very clearly. Imagine a scientist who has come up with some new discovery, and he needs to show to his colleagues at a convention that this discovery is true, that he has lab, you know, reports and tests to back it up and so forth. That's a situation where people in the audience don't yet know what he is trying to prove, and he's offering evidence to prove it. Okay, you follow that? That's completely different from a person who is confronted by his pastor for things that he or she has done, and they have been unwilling to admit that they've done them. Isn't that right? Now, both people, the pastor trying to convince or convict the parishioner, and the scientist trying to persuade his audience, both people use arguments, don't they? Both people appeal to evidence. Both people try to reason logically. But obviously, there's something much different going on when you try to convict somebody of what they already know to be true than when you're trying to bring new information to people. And I think one of the biggest problems apologists have had is that they think that as Christians, we're trying to bring new information to people. And so we're trying to marshal all this kind of evidence the way scientists do to show what the cause of cancer is or whatever the case may be. And I suggest that if you understand self-deception, you'll have a radically different view of what you're doing in apologetics. It's much closer to moral conviction, using arguments to show you must already know this and you're trying to run away from the evidence, than it is to bringing new evidence to the unbeliever. Thanks a lot.